Welcome to the Gallery of Readers podcast. Today we are hearing from John Broglio, who was once called out by a high school teacher for having the greatest trove of useless knowledge I have ever encountered. He went on to use that knowledge well, studying German and French literature, and found a love for theater and performing arts, co-founding a number of theater groups, and more recently writing a chapbook novel called Towards the Pebble Shore, which is available on the Gallery of Readers Press website. I so admire the use of dialect and subtle information in John's writing, and I'm so excited you're here today. Thank you so much for being here, John.
Thank you for having me.
So I know your chapbook is on Shakespeare. Are there any other books on Shakespeare that you'd recommend?
There's a few. I think if you want to get a real feel for the time, there are young adult novels by a guy named Gary Blackwood. The first one is Shakespeare's Scribe, and that gives you a real feeling for theater life in those times. I don't know how he researched them, but
wow,
he did a great job. There's a slim book that's hard to find by Samuel Schoenbaum, A Documentary Life. And that's good because it really divides the myth from the what we can verify. Mm-hmm. And then after you read that, you would read Shakespeare's Wife by Germaine Greer, because she did a lot of, the first half of it is wonderful. She did a lot of research and just brought out stuff that I haven't seen anywhere else.
Oh, wonderful.
And I got to mention Tom Stoppard.
Of course.
Yeah. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Mm. And Shakespeare in Love. I don't know if there's any other playwright that likes Shakespeare as much as Stoppard does.
Mm.
And Shakespeare in Love is funny because everything in it is fiction, but the people in it are accurate and they're kind of magical if you know who they are.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's a great course curriculum for getting into Shakespeare if you're not already. Where would you say your writing comes from, or at least your writing today?
My writing today, I was in the theater, and of course we were all doing experimental theater in those days, so I kind of buried my love for Shakespeare, which I had actually discovered when I was carpooling with my older brother. I was reading his literature book, and I came upon Romeo and Juliet, and I went, this is great.
Wow.
As a freshman, I said, oh, this is much better than what we're reading. And but then I just kind of buried it, because that wasn't what the theater in the 60s and 70s was about.
Mm.
And then I finally gave in. I said, I really love this stuff. I should, you know, do something with it.
Amazing. Do you think that in his time, Shakespeare might have been the experimental theatrician of his day?
I think so. He was, you know, kind of conservative in his politics, but I think his theater was very, he was kind of out there.
Oh, that's great. What makes you feel inspired?
Just about everything.
Okay, great.
Nature gets to me in a big way.
Mm.
Other people's writing, I'll pick up a book and I'll see somebody do something on the page and I'll go, I didn't know you could do that. And that's kind of like, it sends you off in another direction for, at least for an experiment.
Lovely. Do you have a favorite writing prompt or a solve for block?
I try to stop the talking that's constant in my head. And then wait till anything comes up and then just start writing. And if it gets boring, I just try for something new.
Great. Seamless.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's the only thing that works. That's where the chapbook came out of.
Wow.
I just, you know, it came up and I couldn't fight it.
Beautiful. When did you start writing?
We had a teacher in high school who made us keep a journal, a free writing journal, 10 minutes a day, and we had to hand it in. He wasn't going to really look at them for content, just to make sure there was 10 minutes of writing.
Huh.
And that was kind of like, oh, wow. And at that point, I started, you know, I was like 17 or something. I started writing poetry based on that.
Amazing.
The other influence, I think, was my sister, who we went on a shopping trip, Christmas shopping, and I was young. I might have been, I don't know, 12 or 13, maybe a little older. And we came home, and she described our shopping trip, and it was a short story.
Wow.
And I went, wow, you can do that.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. It was like, you know, oh my goodness. Transformation right in front of your very eyes.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. Who are your favorite authors?
Oh my goodness. I have to mention the local authors. People Yay. That I will go to here at a drop of a hat. There's a lot of them, and I won't remember them all, so, but I would say get a Gallery of Readers anthology
yes.
book and just find your favorites, because there's amazing variety of stuff.
Mm, so true. Thank you so much.
These pieces are from a fictional biography of a famous Elizabethan writer. Based on my own experience reading historical fiction, I decided to follow at least two rules. If the main character is famous, I avoid using his or her name. The story should stand on its own without a boost from name dropping. And the reader should have the pleasure of coming to recognize the character. I also obscured other famous names in the story by using an unfamiliar but historical spelling and pronunciation that were apparently used by the actual owners of those names. For me, it adds the freshness of being in a slightly uncomfortable version of a world too often assumed to be familiar. For example, youths as stuff will not endure sounds vague to us, but to an Elizabethan it had a very literal meaning. Youth is a fabric that wears out quickly. Number two, I respect all reasonably knowable facts. When there's a gap in the record, I can invent fictional minor characters and join major ones to big events. I can even make fun of traditional myths and speculations, but I will not falsify known figures or known events. Uncles. A pox on uncles. A great pox to be concealed under white face paint. Then its false recovery. Then its precipitous, unforeseen decline. My mother's sister's husband pillaged my father of a farm. The farm would have made me a gentleman without the trouble of a university degree. My father's brother, Henry, ran up debts over my father's name. It was he, I believe, who married me to a sheep coat to make these brothers whole. I remain silent about how else he may have wronged me there. And it was Uncle Henry, I believe, who poured the sweet papist heresy in my father's ear. While Henry himself farmed parish tithes for the Church of England, thriving on the religion he had my father reject. My feeble revenge on such brothers and uncles was to pillory them on the stage. So Hamlet, the princes in the tower, Prince Arthur, Miranda, Rosalind, must all suffer a corruption of uncles. And under a pox of like brothers must travail Orlando, his duke, Hamlet's father, Prospero, Edgar. True, that uncle bound me to a wife who whose prodigious effort in getting and keeping money kept the family alive. Indeed, she made up with husbandry what she lacked in wifery, as this left much to be desired, or, if you will, too little desire to be satisfied. And she kept us afloat till my own treasure ship hove in sight. But I am ahead of my story. This second piece is from my chapbook. A little bit of background before I start. Scholars have gone back and forth for decades on two issues about Shakespeare's sonnets. Was the publication a bootleg? And did Shakespeare actually write the lover's complaint that is tacked on at the end? Many scholars mistakenly tie the two questions together, although they are easily independent. First, if the bard wrote the lover's complaint, it's easily the worst thing he ever wrote. Second, his two published long poems are alike in every publication detail: dedication, title page, printer, and the sonnets book is different in every detail. Very recent scholarship has convincingly uncovered W.H., the object of the dedication, as a deceased colleague of the printer. That would clinch the bootleg theory. That the piracy may have been accidental would explain why the publication was suppressed within the year, but no other known legal action taken. And now, purloined poesy. This is narrated by a young boy who's an assistant to Shakespeare in his elder age. I'd been reading for the master for a few months when neighbor Abraham Sturley came by with a new book. This is purchased in London for me, he said. Why did you not tell me? Tell you what, the master said. Your new book of sonnets. I've brought nothing to press since Lucretia, years ago. I don't apprehend you, Sturley said. Show me. The master squinted to make out the title page. My name in a title, he said, as if I were a dead man. Philip Sidney lay half score years in the earth, but his book was not Sidney's Arcadia, but the Countess of Pembroke's Arcadia, with the ever-living poet's name writ small beneath. Cynthia, Diana, Fidessa, Idea, Hecatompathia, Stella. Those are book titles for sonnets. Some printer is using my name as birdlime to snare pennies from fools. No offense. He schoolbooks me as you might put William Lilly's name on a new grammar.
But these poems are good and very like your work, Sturley said.
The master handed the book to me. Boy, read something. I was confused. What should I... Hold. Are they numbered? They are. Number 20. One moment, I read. A woman's face with nature's own hand painted. That is mine. How many in all? Well, there's a long poem at the back, sir. I must go Widdershins to find the last sonnet. Ah, CLIV 154. That's what I gifted Lord Pembroke. Dedication, is there a dedication? The dedication is laid out like an ancient tombstone, sir, with a stop chiseled between each word as it were Latin, but only initials for the name. Read it me, he said. I read the few lines. Nothing else? No odes from fellow poets? I find nothing else, sir, front nor back.
A puzzle. When I have written a dedication, it brought me £20 at least, more than I ever got from the printer.
You did not put this to press, Sturley said.
Not a bit. Why would I?
A fistful of sonnets gifted to a man of property gets me a month in the country, rich clothing, or a fine jewel. It is a golden fleece gathered every season till the market goes stale.
A book at a printer's is a haunch of mutton worth a few pennies. Worse, these poems were not for common gaze, but writ for privy friends and fellow poets.
Then who's the object of the dedication? Mr. Sturley asked.
What the devil would I know? The manuscript thief? Or some grave partner of the printer? Hold, boy. What did you skip through at the end when you numbered the sonnets?
It was a complaint, sir.
Well, a complaint would suit a book of sonnets. Read us a little of that.
The lover's complaint, I read. From off a hill whose concave womb reworded a plaintful story from a sistering vale. My spirits to attend this double voice accorded, and down I laid to list the sad-tuned tale.
Again, I read the beginning again. He trips over his own feet. There are six in that last line. Concave womb? That would be a barren one, like the poet's fancy. And yet the barren womb talks. He winked at Master Sturley, like a cunning knight's tale from France. A plaintful complaint, a sistering veil, where all this indirection? Double voice accorded, the echo sings a catch in harmony. Narcissus would be the descant. Now a curious spy would creep to that neighboring valley to spy what is afoot. But this poetaster will lay himself down in the grass, where he should stalk nearer. And what will he see from there but stalks of grass? The echo, the wind, the crawling atomies will outnoise the plaintful story beyond all apprehension. This is a potent vomitory. It must be sold at the apothecary. Some petty scholar, truanting from his hornbook, has rhymed this. His parish priest might love it well. Whose name is signed to it?
Yours, sir, I said, in a fashion, split in half and with an E added in the middle, and a short stroke after the E.
You see, he said to Sturley, one or the other can be inserted to protect the printer's lead. Else the limbs of the K can break the curves of the following S. Richard Field used the E after my K. It alters not the sound. But it needs not both E and the stroke. And who fosters barren verse on me like toadstools on a fallen oak? Sturley, let me buy this from you.
Wherefore?
That when I have stopped up the source, I may burn all the offspring.
I will not let it go, Sturley said. It is too precious for the good things in it.
Would you so treasure my codpiece for a keepsake, man? I'm for London to strangle this changeling in its cradle and to scotch the envious fairy who grafted it on me. Boy, wouldst be a courier? Wouldst come with me to London?
That I would.
Come tomorrow to Greenway's. I will show you how to haggle a horse or two. The Thane of Rue. We took a room at an inn. The master said he no longer had a foot on the ground in London. He would not impose two of us on a fellow sharer.
The ones with lodgings had children and prentices enough. After brief refreshment, the master brushed his clothes and shoes. He arranged and perfumed his hair. He had no neck ruff nor lace cuffs. I followed suit as best I could. We walked to Whitehall. As a member of the king's men, he was recognized and admitted. In the antechambers, he handed me his cloak and approached a knot of well-dressed gentlemen, who proceeded to give him the back of a shoulder and go on talking. "Something is up," he said to me. "We'll to the playhouse, to hear the noise of the court. Silence is all my thrift here." We walked over the Strand, passing many palaces of courtiers who had snubbed us. We went through a city entrance called Ludgate. When we came in sight of great church with the long roof and shattered steeple, we turned to the right and wound our way through lanes. At a great door, the master was recognized and greeted cheerfully. Up the stairs, a man collecting entry fees said, "Not one of yours today, but we are making a good box nonetheless." The master scanned the galleries. Just below the stage, he raised a cautious hand. A young man in rich clothing of sober hue motioned us to come up to the stage where he sat, and he made room for the master. Those around looked on silently. "Do you spy on your rival playmakers that you have come to the playhouse today?" the young earl said. "I helped to choose this play," the master said. "It's a hard task to find one good enough to fill the box, and not so good that it overshadows mine." "You're here early. Don't you know you must enter after the play has begun if you want your applause?"
"Disgusting habit. If I want applause, I scatter pennies."
"Thank you for seeing me, Lord Pembroke. I seem to be out of favor elsewhere."
"Ah, forgive me. I may be the unwilling cause." "We have both been played upon," the earl said. "Ah, that a servant, a scribe, as I suspect, would abuse me so as to copy and sell a private manuscript. I beg you, as a person of I beg you as a person of worship to forgive me."
"A person of quality is forgiven before he asks," the master said. "No ill you might do me could cancel the good you have always done." Pembroke sighed again. "The manuscript you offered for my enjoyment, I mean your own 100 passions. Not long after I received the manuscript, I gave it to my servant, Hugh Sanford, to make a clean copy for me. You must remember him. He had a fine fist for writing and a good ear for verse."
"I do remember. John Florio treated him badly in his World of Words."
"Sanford would have given him cause. He had an inclination to correct verse that was beyond his skill or understanding. I enjoined him not to change an iota. Now he, or perhaps he's someone he set to bind and finish it, must have made yet another copy, which he gave to a stationer named Holm, I believe. Somewhere along the way, the caitiff, or some hireling, added an envoy to the manuscript, a complaint, intended to lengthen the volume and make it more attractive for sale. The villain will have enjoined Holm to keep the volume from the press for some time. Now both Sanford and Holm, may they rest, have gone to their maker. Some stationer friend of Holm will have found the manuscript among his posthumous papers and brought it to press innocently enough with a eulogy to his fellow printer. I have seen the book. All of this was done without my knowledge, and yet I am the guilty party for not preventing the theft. So I must be the one to suppress it, or at least get you compensation. Alas, you know the compensation for a book of verse is given by the subject of the dedication. Then I must make that good to you as well. By no means, my lord, I could not accept. We will see about that, said the earl. But who has taken offense at these trivial private songs, the master wondered. The king, I suspect, perhaps out of vanity, that he does not make such poetry himself, or out of his Augustan public morality, which may hide a Caligulan vice. However much he feigns offense at his poems, his peacock, Robbie Carr, will be whispering them privily in his ear, I'm sure. Most of the court but follow the king in disapproving. The less read, the more offense shown. I know the poems, and I find no offense. What a strange world we live in, the master said. I've had doors closed to me this morning. Alas, what tickles us by candlelight burns us in the sun. I will put it about that you are blameless in this.
Except for having writ the poems.
Every man is allowed his privy intercourse with quill and paper. The theft is my fault. I will sue the printer to desist. And he will not withdraw. I will have recourse to the stationers. They can lay a heavy hand.
That may expose me to more ill fame.
It will be done privily. I thank you, my lord. We need speak of this no more. By and by, the earl said, if the king visit us again, my mother Mary would have you down to Wilton for the occasion.
I am unworthy.
As a poet herself, it would please her to hear you recite something of your own, perhaps something from the quashed publication we speak of. It should be rare by then, et valorem acquirit eundo.
You are braver than I am. As I live, I will come.
Let us hope you live, the earl said. I cannot endure too many evenings of Sejanus.
I excuse you from the play Sejanus, my lord, and the masks. But his fox shows uncommon wit, I think.
You're a hard man to flatter, said the earl, and he nodded us farewell and turned back to his companions as the play was to begin. We left London the following day.
Thank you so much. John's chapbook novel, Towards the Pebble Shore, is available on the Gallery of Readers Press website. So come visit us online, and if you can, share a little abundance, because we are a nonprofit and exist through this community. We would love so much to see you at a reading or hear about a book you're enjoying right now or your favorite line from Shakespeare. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another local author. Until then.